Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Last year, the catastrophic flooding that struck the Texas Hill Country over the 4th of July weekend killed more than 130 people and devastated communities across central Texas. The disaster, though, did not end when the water receded. A new five-part podcast after the flood follows survivors, families, and communities as they confront grief, rebuild their lives, and search for answers about what went wrong. The series also examines the region's continuing vulnerability to flash flooding, the performance of emergency warning systems, and whether reforms adopted since the disaster will be enough to prevent another tragedy. After the Flood is a collaboration between the Texas Newsroom, Texas Public Radio is part of that, and Frontline PBS. Dominic Anthony Walsh is the host and the lead reporter of the series. He's a reporter with Houston Public Media. Dominic, welcome back to The Source.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So, Dominic, when did you realize that the July 2025 flood was not just a breaking news event story? This was something that would require months, maybe years of sustained reporting.
Yeah, I think we in the Texas Newsroom kind of collectively realized that almost as soon as we arrived. You know, I got in a day after the floods, and I'm originally from San Antonio. I'm familiar with Kerrville and Kerr County and, of course, the Guadalupe River. And you could tell as soon as you got into town and along the river just how high it had crested. It was surreal to see. And then talking to folks in the community and those who lost loved ones, it had this profound impact on them. And you could tell their lives were very much changed. It would take a long time to recover. So we knew pretty quickly that this was something we would need to follow over the long term.
Our phone lines are open. We do want to hear from our listeners about their reaction to what happened with the July 4th flood. If it directly impacted you, how are you doing in the recovery? Listeners, what questions do you have about that, those days and the reaction? Why wasn't there a siren system, a warning system? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Dominic, that is one of the issues that you explore in the podcast, is why wasn't there a warning system, and would it have made a difference?
Yeah, so, you know, there actually at one point in Kerr County was a flood warning system. After a flood in 1987, local leaders decided to install an actual flood warning system, gauges that would measure rainfall and river levels in real time and transmit those readings to emergency managers. They had to raise property taxes to cover the cost of the new system, which many residents were not happy about. But after that 87 flood, in which, you know, 10 children from a summer camp died, local leaders recognized that they needed this system. And so it came online, I believe, in 1989. But over the years, the private company that maintained it went defunct, and the system deteriorated and no longer was working by last year. So, you know, during press conferences last year, you would hear county officials say, "We do not have a warning system." There was a warning system, it just didn't work anymore and hadn't worked for years. So, of course, one thing we saw last year after the flood from the Texas legislature was a mandate and some funding to Kerr County to, you know, repair and install a new flood warning system and to install sirens.
But there were opportunities for the Kerr County leadership to put in a new flood system. They chose not to. They had money, federal money that came in. They spent it on other things like radios, communication radios. I remember listening to old meetings in which one county commissioner said, "Well, everyone here who lives in Kerr County knows about flash floods. We don't need a warning system from them. The only reason we would need a warning system is for the outsiders." So it seemed like they had opportunities to rectify the problem, but they chose not to. And it was a deliberate choice.
Yeah, there were conversations over the years about, you know, addressing that warning system that had deteriorated and gone offline, but of course, that didn't happen, and it definitely contributed to what we saw last year with, you know, about 120 deaths just in Kerr County alone.
So what does the podcast After the Flood, what does it reveal about this disaster that news consumers may not have understood from the initial news coverage? What do we gain from listening to your reporting?
Yeah, so I would say the first few episodes, including the two that are out right now, really primarily follow the arc of different people who survived the flood or lost loved ones to the flood. And one of the reason we wanted to, you know, really spend some time following kind of their personal stories was to give it that deeper treatment and, you know, really flesh out these important stories in a way that we don't often hear. So, you know, these are about 30-minute episodes, and, you know, in the first episode, it's all about what happened on the day of, from the perspective of people who narrowly survived, and then also from the perspective of a father of a Camp Mystic counselor who was reported missing that day. And so over the next few episodes, we follow various trajectories, including that father's journey to the Texas Capitol, where he helped pass new camp safety legislation. In terms of new things from the podcast and accountability angles that add value to the conversation for listeners, you know, we in the Texas Newsroom partnered with the Texas Tribune to obtain text messages among emergency officials that were sent in a group chat on July 4th as they were responding to the flood. Those had previously been published by the Texas Newsroom and Texas Tribune, but we re revisit that in the episode that was released today. And then when it comes to new accountability reporting, one of the big questions we have, you know, they have this new expensive flood warning system and siren system. How will it actually be used? Who's actually in charge of it? And, you know, what will lead to their decision to press that button to activate the sirens? We have a reporter in Kerr County right now working to answer that question. And I'll just say, you know, that comes later in the podcast. But so far, Kerr County, who is responsible for deciding when to sound the siren, has been somewhat reluctant to give concrete answers about what would actually trigger that activation.
And having a siren system in and of itself isn't always a solution. We know that, you know, we hear car alarms all the time and just ignore them. There has to be a sustained education campaign that goes along with it that will tell the community and also people who visit the area that this is what that means and this is how you should react when you hear the alarm, so that you can take the correct actions in order to prevent yourself from being in harm's way when the flood comes. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back. We'll get Susie on the air. She's got some comments to make, and you can call in with your questions and comments about the flood that happened about 1 year ago. Were you there? What are your thoughts? What do you think needs to happen moving forward? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll continue discussing After the Flood, the new Texas Newsroom podcast series that dives deep reporting on the Kerrville flood. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. After the Flood, it's a podcast series produced in collaboration with the Texas Newsroom and PBS's Frontline. It's a deeply reported examination of the catastrophic Central Texas flood that killed more than 130 people last 4th of July weekend. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to Susie. And Susie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. I've been here all my life, and I've seen flooding over and over and over again. And so have the people who manage the campgrounds that were flooded. And they knew the flood dangers. What they do is they get FEMA to allow them to basically change the FEMA maps. So areas where they would be restricted from camping, or, I mean, just not even restricted, but to show that camping might be dangerous, the maps are revised so that those floodplains aren't shown correctly. That's a common thing. It's been done. I've watched it happen in cities like New Braunfels after disastrous flooding. Then the FEMA comes in. They measure where the flood levels were. They make a map showing what the new 100-year floodplain is. And then the politics set in. And everybody, all the landowners, don't want to be in the 100-year floodplain, of course. But nature determines that. So a lot of times those maps are redone according to the politics, who squeaks the loudest. Any kind of alarm system that they're talking about putting in will not be good. As long as people can camp down right in that creek, if you will, that's where the Camp Mystic, those cabins were in the 100-year floodplain. They were in the creek. They were in the 20-year floodplain. There's no excuse for that.
All
it's
right.
Pure greed. They could put people, they could move those cabins up on the hill. They have their day activities during the day. And at night, they're in their cabins, which are high up, and they have enough land there to have done that.
Okay. Susie, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. So Dominic Anthony Walsh, the lead reporter on the podcast series After the Flood. We do know that Camp Mystic, they did receive exemptions and were allowed to build cabins where they knew they were vulnerable to flooding. So what does your reporting tell us?
Yeah, so from my understanding, Camp Mystic had a number of buildings that were in what FEMA designated a special flood hazard area. Only one of the cabins had a corner that was in the actual 100-year floodplain, but the entire area had been designated as, you know, potentially hazardous when it comes to floods. There were various appeals. That one cabin was revised to not be in the 100-year floodplain. There definitely is a component of how Camp Mystic interacted with FEMA. That's part of the ongoing wrongful death lawsuits filed by some of the families who lost loved ones against the camp. When it comes to this idea more broadly of what people, you know, can and can't do in the floodway or in the floodplains, it's interesting because one town in Kerr County, Ingram, actually, you know, took a step to address this. They banned RV parks and campgrounds from operating in the floodway itself. And, you know, Ingram was the site of one of the single highest death tolls from a single site that we know of, HTR, Texas Hill Country Resorts, where dozens of RVs were swept away on July 4th. Ingram made this change. It is a small town. The rest of Kerr County has not made that change. And even in Ingram, there was a lot of contention around this change, a lot of, kind of antagonism between the code enforcement officer who was really pushing for it, Stuart Gross, who we speak to for the podcast, and then some of the owners of RV parks. There is this bigger question about where should people be building? Where should they be camping and parking RVs? How close to the river? Because that is part of the draw, you know, being able to be close to the water. But then there's also that danger. So there's a balance there that officials are trying to figure out between some level of, you know, rights for property owners and personal responsibility for campers and RV owners. Versus, of course, kind of the dangers inherent to being in a floodway or a floodplain.
And this is an area widely known as Flash Flood Alley. We've heard from the Kerr County officials, the county judge and all, saying that they had no idea this flood was coming, that they blamed the National Weather Service, that they did not get appropriate warnings about the possibility of this amount of heavy rain. Does that hold up in the reporting that you're doing?
The National Weather Service issued a number of flood alerts, from watches to warnings. And they even tried to get in touch with local officials as the storm was going on. And those calls did not go through. That's according to a new federal report, actually. You know, they were trying to get in touch with Kerr County officials who just didn't pick up the phone when the National Weather Service was trying to call, both to warn them and also to try to get a sense of river levels in parts of the river that didn't have flood gauges. So I know there's been a lot of finger pointing from local officials towards the National Weather Service, but at the state level, you know, the Texas Department of Emergency Management, they were preparing for a major flood a few days in advance. So there seems to have been a disconnect between the local officials and the State Department of Emergency Management and the National Weather Service. And local officials were definitely caught flat-footed. You know, the three top officials in Kerr County who were responsible for kind of running the emergency operations, the county judge, the emergency management coordinator, and the sheriff were either sick, asleep, or out of town that morning as the floodwaters were really devastating their county.
I mean, I understand if you're sick, you're sick. People get sick. But when you do that, you have to appoint someone to take your place in these calls. And they didn't do that. You can compare Kerr County's preparation and response to Kendall County's preparation and response, and they're very different stories, and you have very different outcomes. So, I mean, I think that needs to be highlighted in looking at, you know, there's responsibilities that need to be held accountable. So, the death toll also, as in the days after the flood, was very confusing about, you know, we difficult to get good numbers. Why was that so hard?
Well, you know, I would, this was a massive flood. There was a massive search and recovery effort. I do remember being on the ground in the days that followed. And at one point, you know, after the officials were kind of dodging the question of how many people were missing for a number of days. And then they suddenly, a few days after the flood, released a number saying that more than 200 people were missing. So there was a moment when it seemed like the death toll was even more significant than the massive number that it ended up being. So that said, once they released that number, people were accounted for slowly over the course of time. And then, of course, more bodies were recovered. But you're right, it took a number of days before there was some certainty and concrete information around the number of people who died in this flood.
In your reporting for the podcast after the flood, you tried to talk to some of these emergency officials afterwards for Kerr County, and they wouldn't give you an interview. What happened?
Yeah, so the person that we are extremely interested in talking to, his name is Shorey Harmon. He is the new emergency management coordinator in Kerr County after the previous emergency management coordinator, William Dub Thomas, resigned, or rather retired. Shorey Harmon, everybody is telling us, is the person to talk to about how this new emergency system will work in practice. How will the sirens be activated? He has attended a couple public events in which he's outlined some of the planning that they've gone through. But the question that still hasn't been answered is, okay, what exactly is the protocol to activate the sirens? You know, how much rain has to fall? Like, well, you know, what leads you to press the button? That hasn't been answered. And Kerr County is currently not responding to media requests. They're not granting interviews. So our reporter who's over in Kerr County right now is still trying to make contact with Shorey Harmon. A reporter from Texas Public Radio actually working with us just last week, I believe, did approach Shorey Harmon after one of these public meetings and asked him a few questions. He said he was not able to do media interviews, but did give a broad outline of this idea that he will be watching the river levels. He will be in touch with other officials, and, you know, various factors will contribute to that decision. But we still don't have a formal interview or a statement from him. And Kerr County in general has been, you know, difficult to get a response from.
So the morning of the flood, there were calls on the radio from deputies in the field, law enforcement officers who are dealing with emergency rescues. They said they needed to issue a red alert, a certain alert, and they couldn't do that at the emergency center because they needed permission, but they couldn't get the sheriff or whoever is authorized to give that alert to go. That seemed like important time was lost that could have given people warning.
You know, the code red alert is complicated to kind of analyze. We do know from a briefing at the state level from the investigator that the state legislature commissioned to look into what happened with the flood, especially at Camp Mystic, that an alert was sent relatively early through code red. So the actual timeline of the code red is still somewhat squishy and hard to analyze. But there is, I think, the broader question of how many people actually got that alert. It's sent through text messages, from what I understand. And so there are issues with cell connectivity. And of course, you know, visitors from out of town who might not have signed up for that voluntary alert system.
So that was the issue. This was the July 4th weekend. The river was at, you know, all the RV parks, Howdy's, everything was over. You know, people had booked these things. They were looking forward to a wonderful, beautiful weekend. They were out-of-towners, and that's why the death toll was so high. How do we try to communicate to everyone that, you know, although the river looks calm today, it could look very different hours later?
Yeah, so one change that I've heard about is some of this warning information being posted in Airbnbs and vacation rentals in Kerr County. So when people, you know, come into town to visit and stay at one of these spots, there'll be some information about how they can go and look at information related to these new river gauges. So that's a piece of progress. But yeah, you're right. There is this question about whether local officials have done enough to really communicate some of the dangers to visitors from out of town who might not know that this is Flash Flood Alley and just how quickly things can go sideways.
The podcast is very emotional. You really have to be aware that this is, you're going to get the feels listening to the podcast, Dominic. And so people, the deep reporting, talking to people who are directly connected. There's an emotional anchor. As you said, the father talking about his lost daughter. So much is going on in this podcast. And so that must have been, it's taken a lot of time and effort to produce this.
Yeah, and we include a note to listeners in every episode, and I would repeat that here, that these are tough stories to listen to. They do deal with traumatic moments and death. So, you know, I definitely encourage folks to take care while listening. This podcast has been a year in the making, and I am deeply grateful to the people who took the time to share their stories and meet with us again and again, time after time over the past year, to revisit these moments and also to talk about kind of their journey since then.
Yeah, and hopefully we can prevent this from happening again. After the flood, we're going to air episode 2 on this week's Texas Matters program. We aired episode 1 last week, and you can find it wherever you get your podcast. And Dominic Anthony Walsh, thank you. And thanks to everyone else who worked with you on this in the Texas Newsroom for producing this and coming on air today.
Thank you, Dave.
When we come back from the break, helping the river heal by replanting along the Guadalupe. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The catastrophic flooding that tore through the Guadalupe River last July did more than destroy homes, roads, and communities. It also ripped out thousands of trees, stripped away riverbanks, and severely damaged the habitat that helps protect the river and the people who live along it. Now the San Antonio Botanical Garden is leading an ambitious effort to help restore that landscape. The initiative is called Trees, Texas Recovery for Ecological and Environmental Safety. The goal is to grow and plant 50,000 native trees using seeds collected from the Guadalupe River region to reduce erosion, stabilize riverbanks, and begin rebuilding the damaged ecosystem. But restoring a river corridor after a disaster of this scale is not as simple as just throwing out seeds onto the ground. It requires years of growing, planting, monitoring, and the cooperation of landowners and communities and volunteers throughout the Hill Country. Join us in the studio to tell us more. We're Andrew LeBay, the Chief Mission Officer at the San Antonio Botanical Garden, and Michael Eason, the Garden's Vice President of Conservation and Collections. Andrew and Michael, welcome to The Source. It's great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let me ask you first, I want to hear from both y'all, but Andrew LeBay, first off, so when you first visited the Guadalupe River after the flood, what did you see that told you that this is not just storm damage, but this is a really a massive long-term ecological crisis that needed intervention?
Yeah, the devastation, the loss of the huge old-growth bald cypress that are along the river, those were some of the early indications that we had. And of course, in those early days, we saw that. We saw the devastation on many levels, and we were at the garden asking ourselves, what could we do, and where does our expertise lie? And so that's really where it was born.
And Michael, when you saw the river after the flood, what did you see? Did you realize there was necessary to take action?
Yes. I visited probably about 10 days after the event. But I'm sure we all saw the videos of those massive 3-4 foot diameter trees being taken out by the flood. And when you see something of that magnitude, you know that it's not your normal yearly flood or every 5-year flood that we might have in the Hill Country. It was something that was going to have devastating effects on the ecology of the river.
I was there last week on the Guadalupe, and you could see, of course, still the trees that are gone and their emptiness. The ones that were there, you notice it kind of almost looks like a vacant lot in some places. And that this is, it has that, it hits you in the face right away that this is not normal and this is not healthy for the system, Michael.
Right. It is really hard to gauge how many trees we lost. You can see in areas where I've stood and took photographs, and you can go back and look at satellite coverage, and you can see easily, depending on where you're standing, 50 to 90% of the trees are just gone. And it definitely looks like in areas, parking lot, without anything else there, where the gravel was deposited and the sycamores, the ash trees, the cypress trees, everything that was there before is just pretty much has been wiped away. And what you're seeing now is sort of nature's response, which is those pioneer species that they're reacting to that disturbance. So you're seeing a lot of growth of what most people would call weedy species. And so that's that parking lot feel that you're probably talking about.
833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'd love to hear from our listeners about their thoughts, what they've seen, what they want to do, how they're going to respond to restoring the natural world of along the Guadalupe River after the flood. It's incredible, though, Andrew, that such massive, majestic bald cypress were uprooted. And that tells the story of the magnitude of the flood. I mean, I didn't even know. I mean, it's incredible when you see these huge trees just on their sides.
Yeah, that hit many of us immediately, too. I mean, because those are so iconic.
But how old were those kind of trees?
hundreds, some of the bigger ones. So I think they're, you know, reports up to 200-300 years old for some of the larger species or the larger specimens.
And so why not just say, okay, this is nature and nature heals and just let it run its course?
Yeah, and certainly there is, and there will be recruitment, there will be growth back, but we decided that, you know, it was also good to intentionally help that process speed up and be intentional about what is being replanted in that area. So part of the project is collecting local and growing that out and giving it back.
And so, Michael, is the concern that invasive species will fill the void if you guys don't take a response and put in the Texas natives?
Definitely the invasive species. This is kind of where they shine in those disturbed areas. So things like the giant kang, the Arundodonax, chinaberry.
You don't want chinaberry. People need to learn to recognize chinaberry and take it out. Okay.
Ligustrum, and then other things like Vitex and some of the grass species, and they'll just take off at this point. This is more, I like to tell people this is not a landscaping project. It's very intentional what we're doing. Andrew had just alluded that we collected seed locally, and that was part of this project, is that the genetics are from the Guadalupe watershed. So we did not bring anything from outside of that area.
Well, did you have those things already on hand? How did you collect all that?
Nope. We reached out to some landowners pretty early on just to make sure we can get access and to areas within in the watershed, areas that were not affected by the flood. And with that, we made our initial trips and we recognized, okay, this is a population we can collect from. And we have parameters that we try to follow. So we're collecting from at least 50 different individuals to capture those genetics and bring those. We're not collecting from just one tree.
Oh, yeah.
So that way I think we ended up collecting from about 200 to 250 different individuals throughout the watershed for the cypress only.
I'm going to go to a caller, 833-877-8255. And Robert, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you. This is Robert. I'm a Burke County and City of San Antonio resident, and I understand the city has helped you all with some funding over there at the Botanical Garden. And I was wondering, have you ever done a project like that here in Burke County in the City of San Antonio? And what is the cost for this project over there in that county?
All right. So, I mean, it does seem like we all know the San Antonio Botanical Gardens as this fantastic landscape that's cultivated and beautiful and fantastic place to visit. I've never heard about y'all doing a project like this. So is this brand new, and could this be a template for other efforts? So let's go to Andrew.
Yes. So to this scale, it is novel, it's new. We have a long history of stewarding endangered species across the state, developing landowner connections, and working with the Center for Plant Conservation. So native plants of Texas has long been a focus of the San Antonio Botanical Garden. This type of project, this scale of project, is something that is new for the garden. But there are some examples across the nation of other botanical gardens doing similar types of projects, like, for example, in Naples Botanical Garden in South Florida, working on beach restoration after hurricane damage. For us, this is a new one.
So I want to talk about, so people are talking, automatically thinking about the trees, okay? And as you said, those cypress trees are hundreds of years old. You're not going to be able to install these massive trees. But the grasses is something else that we have to think about. So what are the grasses that need to be, you know, you're giving out grass seeds. Mm-hmm. So what kind of grass are we talking about? Should we learn to recognize these grass and make sure that they thrive and other grass doesn't?
Right. So that was mainly headed by Hill Country Alliance. So that group, they were sort of the first ones there on the ground right after the flood, helping with, you know, people understand, don't remove all of the debris. We kind of need some of this. And then we worked with them on it's the river long-term river recovery group. So there was a large group of a couple dozen institutions, organizations that were working together to help the river restore. Hill Country Alliance took the lead on the grasses. And so they spread the seeds out or passed the seeds out to landowners and let them spread them along the banks. Most recently, they did a plant giveaway with some of those plants. So the grasses that we're looking at are things like eastern gamma grass, which is a large bunch grass, switch grass, bushy bluestem, and then some of the sedges like emery sedge and some of the spike rushes that you find right along the edge of the river. So those are the ones that were initially put out and thrown out, and they definitely took seed, took root, and they did that the seed distribution was last year.
And the grass will then put out seed and will and continue to grow. But someone's got to get the initial seed out there, get it in the ground, and then make sure you don't pull that up. So we're going to talk more about helping the river heal. Okay, the river will heal, but, you know, having a guiding hand, experts with the resources in order to do it right, will bring back not just the natural beauty, but the benefits of having this net vegetation along the river. We're going to talk more about that when we come back from the break. You can call in with your questions and comments. If you want to volunteer, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Trees, Texas Recovery for Ecological and Environmental Stability. That is a plan to restore the native vegetation along the flood-damaged Upper Guadalupe River in Kerr County. The plan is to restore 50,000 native trees and also grasses and shrubs and other important vegetation in the area. It's part of the healing after the devastating flood. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255. We're in studio with Andrew LeBay, the Chief Missions Officer at the San Antonio Botanical Garden, and Michael Eason. He is the Garden's Vice President for Conservation and Collections. So 50,000 native trees. Okay, so what does that look like? What are we talking about here? Are you going to put in like little tiny starter trees, or how's that?
Yes, so we collected last fall about 850,000 seed, and this seed has been in different nurseries across the state producing, and so we're talking about smaller, what we call plugs or small seedling trees that would be going in. And so we're now at a state where we have thousands and thousands of trees ready to move forward this fall in planting.
So how do you keep people from, you know, tubers or whoever else, recreational people, from stomping on those trees? I've been to places like in Rhode Island or whatever, they're trying to restore the grasslands, and they're very directed, like, do not walk in this swamp because you're going to kill everything we're working on.
Yeah, and it's going to be site-by-site differences because we're looking at both public and private lands, and so it could be signage, it could be fencing. We're also thinking about deer. We're putting up deer protection. The deer protection will also be signals, you know, for people, and so just site by site.
Man, the deer situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, they eat everything, don't they? Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so let's go to Steve on the phones, 833-877-8255, for you to jump in the conversation like Steve. And Steve, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hey.
Yeah, well, I already gave my comment. What, have I got to say it again?
You did, because that was to the producer, and we didn't get it on the radio.
Oh, I see. Okay. On July 3rd, 2025, I came in from lunch from my workshop, and the smartphone showed a broadcast from some San Antonio news station. I'm not sure which call letters, but they had a 12-hour warning that the river was going to rise over 33 feet, and if you had an RV at any of the campsites, whether you was camping there that weekend or not, you better go get them, or you probably won't see them again. They advise people that camping along the river to clear, and people who lived along the river to get out. And to me, Kerr County dropped the ball big time. And a lot of people lost their lives needlessly. And I have the Guadalupe. It runs through my neighborhood here in Spring Branch, and it come up over the limestone bluffs that are about 20 feet high, and it was well over them. And I was well downriver from that. And I went there on the 4th as close as I could in comfort, and it was spooky to hear all the trees and limbs breaking, because that river was just out of control.
So you have the Guadalupe on your land, is that right?
Well, not on my land, in my neighborhood,
And how's it look now? Does it? Do you see the vegetation just scraped off?
Well, I'm not concerned so much about the vegetation as much as I am the people that got killed needlessly.
I got you, Steve. Thank you for calling in. We appreciate your input on that. So let's talk about the connection between having a robust vegetative landscape and public safety. These things are connected. So, Michael, if you can talk about, why do the replanting? Why have these trees, and what it does to the energy of the river and how it makes a difference?
Sure. So anyone that's driven that river road or has been through Kerrville or along the Guadalupe, when you look out there, you typically mostly would see sort of this ring of cypress trees. And that is not necessarily a healthy situation when it comes to the ecology of the river. Ideally, you want a very large buffer from the banks of the river, going through that first initial floodplain where you would see floods typically every year. Those plants, whether it's grasses, trees, understory, whatever it may be, when the water rises, that energy is dissipated by coming into contact with those trees. And so that slows that water down, allows it to get absorbed. It allows the silt, the gravel, everything else that it's carrying to sort of drop out in various areas. And anyone that's visited a river, year after year after year, you might say, oh, this is the perfect swimming hole. And then 2 years later, you show up and there's, after a flood, it can be filled with gravel. And that's just that natural deposition that happens with the flow of the river. That's, rivers change. They're, in a sense, living. They don't stay the same year to year. But that's the importance of having this highly diverse species, numerous trees, and these zones of riparian plants that help slow that river down. And that's just one part of it. You can also look at the uplands as well. The limestone uplands where you need those grasses to help slow that water down before it even gets to the river. So it's all part of one system that's flowing down.
Yeah, so I've been wondering about that too, about those tributaries that go into the Guadalupe. A lot of them were flooded out as well. Mm-hmm. Are they going to get this treatment?
Any landowner that reaches out to us that was affected by the flood, we will talk to them and go out and visit with them, and hopefully we have enough plants to get to them. 50,000 trees is going to go pretty quickly.
I was up in Sandy Creek in Travis County near Leander. Same thing happened to them. They had a lush Texas forest right along Sandy Creek, and that was all wiped out. Mm-hmm. And those people feel like that, because it's a different county and a different, river basin, it flows into the Colorado River, that they're not being included in these plans. So,
yeah, I believe Tree Folks is working with folks up there in that Austin area, and it just logistically, it's where we're working. It's a little bit easier for us to travel over to Kerrville in that area and work locally. And like I said, Tree Folks and some of the other organizations are working with some folks up there.
So, Andrew, how is this? I mean, this is a huge undertaking. How is this being funded?
So it's private donations, and I can say that you can go to our website or Google San Antonio Botanical Garden Trees Initiative, and that's got a lot of the information that we're talking about here. It's got our funder lists down at the bottom, and you can find that information there.
Michael, are you trying to recreate the or improve the what the vegetation along the river?
We would like to make it better than what it was. So hopefully with working with landowners one-on-one, they'll see the benefits of keeping a wider plant corridor there along the river and maybe not mowing all the way down to the water's edge and keeping that sort of really crisp, pristine look that folks are looking for sometimes. And there has been changes. A lot of people, they probably never heard the word riparian or provenance plants, which is just where we find them in the wild, and beginning to understand that the river itself has given so much to the community, and now it's the river really needs that community's help to be healthy again. And we've had just an insane number of people that have reached out to us there at the garden, whether it's a landowner needing some plants for their section of the riverbank, or folks that just want to help with volunteerism, or if it's we have property elsewhere in Kerr County where we can come and collect seed.
And so are volunteers needed, Andrew?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is very much a community effort. Michael talked about the Hill Country Alliance. We're working with a lot of different groups. We've already had a large number of volunteers help clean seed. We'll be doing that again come winter time, but the planting phase, we're looking for volunteers to help out plant.
This doesn't seem like a one and done kind of a thing.
No, and that's, we were very intentional about, we're not just planting trees or giving away trees and walking away. We're in it for the long-term survival. There could be cases where we're replanting areas, but we're also focused on that these trees are established, that they're watered, that they're followed through in order to get the highest take that we can. We will have losses of trees, but we're looking for the highest success rate over time.
And Michael, how long does it take for one of those little plugs of bald cypress to become noticeable? I mean, it's
they're
a slow-growing tree,
now.
Right? it isn't a slow-growing tree?
It's not as slow as oaks. We could probably have a, say, 15 to 20 foot tree in about 7 years. So,
yeah.
Some of the seedlings that our partner nurseries have grown, they're already 18 inches tall. So
they're taken.
Yeah, they're taken.
And the soil is good. All that's still there.
That's all part of the site selection of when we go out. We're not planting in gravel. We're going to be planting in soil.
Well, maybe you need to throw out some mulch and some other things out there. All
right,
Andrew LeBay, Chief Missions Officer at the San Antonio Botanical Garden. Michael Eason is the Garden's Vice President of Conservation Collection. They're helping lead up Trees, Texas Recovery for Ecological and Environmental Stability, restoring 50,000 native trees along the flood-damaged Guadalupe River in Kerr County. Thank you both for joining us today. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.
A year ago, one of the deadliest floods in U.S. history tore through the Texas Hill Country. Since then, we've been following up with survivors.
Everything is gone.
And people who lost loved ones.
I find myself just
shaking my head, saying, I can't believe I find myself here.
You can hear their stories on the podcast After the Flood from the Texas Newsroom and PBS's Frontline, out now.